He didn't want to seem selfish, didn't want his teammates to be mad at him. Now Durant's father was talking trash, swaggering, letting everyone within shouting distance know that even though he'd been out of the picture for 10 years, even though he'd left Wanda to raise the kids all by herself, he was still the man, and Kevin was only a boy. Wayne Pratt was huge, strong, and Kevin was Kevin, thin, gentle, watchful, kind. And so the father scored and scored and scored with brutal efficiency, and the boy could get nothing. Maybe it was a lesson, an alpha thing. You have to be mean to survive. Winning was not something the world was just going to hand you. If you wanted it, you had to go out and take it. Kevin Durant, however, could only take so much. As the blowout escalated, as his father celebrated, as his brother watched on the sideline, KD broke down. He burst into tears and ran away, into the empty house. He closed the garage behind him and locked every single door. He refused to let anyone in. For a long time, he just sat there alone, with the whole house to himself, crying. I knew this story because Durant told it to me, out of the blue, 13 years after it happened. We were sitting in the Thunder's luxurious practice facility, surrounded by all of Sam Presti's perfectly straight balls, an impossible distance from that East Coast driveway in 1999. Durant was telling me the story, he said, because that moment had changed him. Locked alone in the house, with tears on his face, 11-year-old Durant had an epiphany. I sat back and thought about it, he said, glancing over at me with his big soft eyes. I was like, what am I so mad at? In that moment of emotional overload, he said, he made a decision. It's good to be passionate, it's good to hate losing, but I've got to channel it in the right way. After a while, I started to learn to leave it where it's at, get rid of it. Once you're done and you're off the court or out of the venue or whatever, go back to being you. Every sports superstar becomes a cartoon. That's the nature of superstardom. Some cellular speck of an actual human is extracted, exploded, and then reproduced infinitely, internationally, in simple lines and primary colors, and presented as if it were the actual person. Michael Jordan was epic, noble, willpower champion. Magic Johnson was smiley, sunshine, party friend. The cartoon version of Kevin Durant, the greatest scorer of his or possibly any generation, and the savior of Oklahoma City, was nice. Just that. Nice. KD is nice. It wasn't much, but it was enough to differentiate him, in the eyes of the public, from some of his predecessors and peers. NBA superstars were not known for being nice. They got paraded through news cycles for doing bad things, punching teammates, choking coaches, berating refs, wagering small fortunes unwisely, recording terrible rap albums, keeping guns in their lockers, engaging in dogfighting, driving luxury cars at high speeds on public roads, instigating ugly contract disputes, giving long speeches about the silliness of practice, showboating after dunks, smoking illegal drugs. Perhaps you detect subtle racial overtones to that list. For the first several decades of its existence, this was one of the NBA's defining PR tensions, and one that it sometimes handled poorly. It was a multi-billion dollar business designed to sell the performances of young black multimillionaires, many of whom, like Durant, grew up poor in the nation's poorest communities, to a largely white, largely middle class, largely suburban audience. Such tensions were particularly fraught in the case of the Oklahoma City Thunder, a new NBA franchise in a state historically dominated by the white and rural right-wing poor, a demographic for whom hip-hop culture was not a thrilling expression of American creativity, but a crisis, an invasion, a post-apocalyptic nightmare vision of the very end of the nation. Oklahoma was often referred to, with either pride or loathing, as the reddest state in the nation. It was the target audience for right-wing radio's conspiracy theories about the New World Order, and, particularly in those days, Barack Obama's Kenyan birth. In 2008, the year the Thunder arrived, Oklahoma was the only state in the nation where Obama did not win a single county. But Kevin Durant was nice, and niceness, it turned out, did a surprising amount of ideological work. Although KD's official biography claimed that he had been raised in a suburb of Washington, D.C., He could just as easily have been dreamed up in a laboratory by the Oklahoma City Chamber of Commerce. He was the perfect bridge between the NBA and Oklahomans. His pregame routine involved kissing his mother, as did his postgame routine, which also involved reading the Bible. His personal motto, which he was glad to repeat at any time, for any reason, was a bit of Yoda-like egalitarianism. Hard work beats talent when talent fails to work hard. In Durant's 1 year of college at the University of Texas, during what was probably the greatest freshman season in NCAA history, a reporter asked him if he realized that he had just single-handedly outscored the entire opposing team in the second half of a game. Durant answered, with what seemed like absolute sincerity, "Who, me?" That was Kevin Durant, baby-faced angel of humility. In 2010, Durant signed a new contract to stay with the Thunder for 5 years. But you got the feeling he would have signed on for the rest of his life if the players' union would have allowed it. He seemed to have formed a perfect mind meld with the people of OKC. He would go to the mall by himself, with no security, just to hang out. He'd play pickup basketball with almost anyone. Neighborhood kids would come knock on the door of his house and he'd invite them inside to play video games. He talked frequently about how he couldn't imagine ever leaving, how he wanted to live and win in Oklahoma City forever. Durant was so exactly what this city needed, on so many levels, and he seemed like a one-franchise guy, all the way down to his very long bones. He would do for OKC what Tim Duncan did for San Antonio, or Dirk Nowitzki did for Dallas, would bring stability, awards, championships, 2 decades of good times. But in this case, it would mean so much more, because Oklahoma City didn't have a tenth of what those places had. Durant had no tattoos. Zero of them, not a single tattoo anywhere on his entire body, an absence that was often cited by Oklahomans in the early years as evidence of his virtue. Oklahoma was the last state in America to legalize tattoo parlors in the year, believe it or not, 2006. Durant was so deeply nice, it seemed, that his skin repelled tattoos. During post-game interviews, he wore a little tiny backpack, like a cheerful fourth grader who had stopped to chat on his walk home with a neighbor who happened to be out watering the lawn. A reporter once asked him what he kept in the backpack. He said water and his Bible. When I asked the Thunder's head coach, Scott Brooks, if all the rumors of Durant's otherworldly niceness were true, he laughed. "I mean, why even ask?" he said. "Whatever you say nice, you can print it out and I'll just say I said it, because it's true." So it was true. KD was nice. But what kind of a force, exactly, was niceness? In Durant's 5 years in the league, he had become a transcendent player. There was no arguing that. The one consistent criticism of him, however, was that he was maybe a little too nice, that he wasn't aggressive enough, that too often he failed to use his nuclear skills with maximum violence, the way a meaner player, Jordan, Barkley, Iverson, Kobe, would have. Durant's basketball arsenal was unfair, but sometimes it looked like he was trying to use it in a fair way. There were times during games when he seemed slightly removed from the action, simultaneously present and absent. Part of this may just have been his incredible level of skill. It looked so easy for him to stroke 4 consecutive 3-pointers or to toss in a little running half hook over 2 defenders that it was tempting to imagine he was thinking about other things the whole time, that the real Kevin Durant was watching from a little viewing platform deep inside his own head, reading a magazine, clipping his nails, ready to engage fully again when things got suitably intense. But what if it was something more fundamental? What if Durant was just, at the core of his being, a little passive and deferential? At the Olympics, Durant was by far the best scorer on the floor, but LeBron James told reporters that he sometimes had to beg him to shoot, as if the U.S. national team were only AAU ball and KD was trying not to hurt anyone's feelings. During the waning days of the Harden crisis, Thunder practices frequently turned angry. Harden was pumped up on praise and beginning to explore the ever-growing borders of his talent. In scrimmages, he drove hard against Westbrook and Durant, talking trash, tweaking the established order. Sometimes, Harden's practice squad of backups and rookies actually beat the first team, which sent everybody, especially Durant and Westbrook, into ruthless competitive overdrive. When I sat down with Durant a few minutes after one of these hostile practices, he showed no trace of negative energy. He was calm, polite, thoughtful, obliging. We sat on chairs at the edge of the gym, and he said pretty much everything you would expect him to say in exactly the way you would expect him to say it. He went out of his way to praise his teammates, singling out Westbrook as a killer, and insisting that, despite the media's constant attempts to create controversy between them, there was no tension about sharing the ball. It would be ridiculous to put Westbrook on a leash, Durant said, just so I can get two or three more shots up a game. He praised his teammates' unselfishness and said he had learned to play unselfishly too. He told me that, although he'd known almost nothing about Oklahoma City before the team moved there, now he couldn't imagine playing anywhere else. When I tried to compliment Durant on the way he'd handled his contract extension in 2010, announcing it quietly in a tweet as opposed to LeBron James's public showboating, he, characteristically, wouldn't accept it. In fact, Durant seemed mildly offended by the attempt to praise him at someone else's expense. He defended LeBron, pointing out that their situations were completely different. LeBron was in a later phase of his career. KD was just extending his rookie deal. Anybody, Durant said, would have signed the extension he did. And when the time came for his own next contract, he said, who knew what he would do? This struck me as laughable, to imagine KD doing anything like what LeBron had done. Holding the nation hostage in a high-stakes free agency showdown, making a spectacle of himself, abandoning a small, hard-luck organization in a humble middle American city for a glitzy super team on the coast. It was anathema to everything Durant stood for. At that moment, KD and LeBron were at opposite ends of the NBA's moral spectrum. I told Durant that all over town, people kept giving me spontaneous speeches about what a nice guy he was. He was Oklahoma City Gandhi. His response was impeccably nice. I'm just being me, man, he said. I'm just enjoying this all. I wasn't raised to be a jerk to anybody, you know what I mean? My mama wouldn't like that, so that's just all I know, being nice to people and enjoying what I do. But how is it possible, I asked, to be as competitive as he must be while also being so nice? Didn't those impulses conflict? This was when Durant told me, out of nowhere, the story of his father destroying him in the driveway in the game of one-on-one. The trash-talking, the shoving, the humiliation, the lonely weeping locked inside the house. In the years since that incident, Durant had obviously succeeded brilliantly in internalizing the lesson of the day. He had learned to master his negative emotions, to present himself publicly as faultlessly nice. Occasionally, however, if you watched closely, you could see Durant shuttling between worlds. He would dunk and, in his excitement, begin to stare down his opponent, showboat style, and you'd think, wait a second, that's not how KD acts. And then, inevitably, a second or so later, he would catch himself and jog back down the court to give all the credit, nicely, to whichever of his teammates had set him up. He would get clobbered on a drive and turn to the referee with hatred in his eyes, but then he would turn away before he created an incident or got a technical foul. It was hard to tell how much of KD's niceness was real, essential to him, and how much was a projection of the image he knew people wanted to see, especially in Oklahoma. Durant was still a very young man, and I wondered if he had imprinted, in a way, on OKC and its expectations. He was not, it seemed to me, uncomplicatedly nice. Durant knew that he was being watched, and he knew the nature of that watching. He'd become an expert in watching himself being watched. He had learned to modulate with exact precision his transitions between niceness and not niceness. You could sometimes see the impulse and the correction, to get Freudian for a second, the id and the superego. Eventually, toward the end of our conversation, Durant leaned over and started unlacing his shoes. I took this as a signal that he was ready to leave. He was tired, no doubt, and had other things to do. I wrapped up the interview and thanked him for his time. He popped immediately out of his seat and started walking away in huge strides across the gym. After a few steps, however, he caught himself. He turned around, walked back, and shook my hand. "Nice to meet you," he said. Once you noticed the small gaps in Durant's public persona, you started to see them everywhere. One of his early signature moves, for instance, and a source of at least mild controversy, was a trick called the rip-through. Durant would whip his long, skinny arms, on purpose, into the arms of an unwitting defender, getting himself intentionally tangled up, and after that forced contact, would fling a fake dead duck of a shot in order to make it look like he had been fouled in the act of shooting. The defender, having done nothing wrong, would be called for a foul. This wasn't basketball, it was a swindle. The rip-through didn't violate the rules, so it wasn't exactly cheating, but it was done in the spirit of cheating. It was, if such a thing is possible, cheating within the rules, a paradox of nice, not niceness. Durant used the move so often that the league was forced to modify its rules in 2011. When the Oklahoman asked Durant about the rip-through, his answer was the exact opposite of the golden rule. "When a guy does it on me," Durant said, "I don't think it's a good basketball play. But when I do it, it is. Not nice." Also, it turned out, to many Oklahomans' dismay, that Kevin Durant had a lot of tattoos. A whole lot of them. In fact, Durant's entire torso, which everyone had always assumed was nice and blank, there in the secret regions under his jersey, turned out to be covered back and front with ink. The tattoos were, as far as tattoos go, incredibly wholesome. Not a skull or a dagger or a naked lady in sight. Nothing that could even begin to be interpreted negatively. They formed, in the aggregate, a heartwarming pictorial autobiography of the world's most wholesome man. A drawing of the house he grew up in, a crucifix, a Texas Longhorns logo in honor of his one-year college alma mater, two Bible verses, the names of his mother, Wanda, and his grandmother, Barbara, topped by a rose and a dove. Still, secret tattoos. Although Durant's body art was angelic, literally angelic, it kicked off a firestorm, one local told me, in Oklahoma. A shirtless picture of Durant circulated on the internet, and some fans decided he had perpetrated a conspiracy, had fooled them into believing he was something he was not. He had been a Trojan horse of niceness. They had welcomed him into their city, and look what had happened. Tattoos. There were passionate debates. Eventually, in most cases, Durant was forgiven, because winning does a lot. But it was a tiny grain of sand in the previously smooth public narrative of KD's niceness. As the new season started, Kevin Durant and his business tattoos were expected not only to lead Oklahoma City back to the finals, but to win it all this time. And to do so under constant scrutiny as a paragon of pure moral virtue and noble humility, as a representative of everything Oklahoma City had always desperately dreamed that it could be. World-class, first-rate, special, stable, dominant, permanent, forever. The Grand Canal. In the fall of 1889, after the fed-up federal government stepped in to strip OKC of self-rule, the humiliated city refused to abandon its grand plans. If anything, its plans got even grander. Oklahoma City's civic powers announced the launch of a transformative new undertaking, a project so huge it promised to vault the place up the ranks of real American cities. Like Venice or Beijing, Oklahoma City was going to build itself a grand canal. It would harness almighty nature and put her to work. The North Canadian River was a lovely waterway, twisting in crazy loops all through the center of town. But it was also a typical prairie river, which meant that it was temperamental, drying up and flooding at seemingly random intervals. All through that first summer, the river had been overflowing its banks, turning the city's streets into a muddy, stinking mess. The city powers had frankly had enough of its nonsense. They wanted the river to behave more like the railroad. Rational, industrious, straight. This was the era of triumphant global canals, and the city's newspapers were full of inspiring examples of hydroengineering. There were new canals in Panama, Suez, Nicaragua, the Baltic Sea. A 16-mile-long canal in England was entirely underground. A 5,000-year-old Egyptian irrigation ditch still ran alongside the Nile. Oklahoma City, at 6 months old, could see no reason not to join this glorious tradition. Digging equipment rolled into the city in early December, in what one newspaper described as an almost endless procession of wagons. Through the city's first bleak winter, when jobs were scarce and supplies were low, hundreds of men worked to dig the canal. These wages almost certainly saved families from starving. Spring arrived, and the men continued to dig. They dug all through the summer. The canal began to stretch around the town. Excitement over the project grew into a collective fever. All of Oklahoma City poured its hopes into the still dry trough. Businessmen built mills and factories and cotton gins along its length. City leaders made plans for the canal to power an extensive system of streetlights and trolleys. It was the rare project that everyone could support, Seminole and Kickapoo alike. The Grand Canal, Bunky wrote, was the most gigantic undertaking in Oklahoma Territory or in the entire Southwest. And then he added, characteristically, as if time had collapsed and the project was already done, "It has made her the metropolis and commercial center of the territory, and in the future will be her beacon light." In the end, the Grand Canal took one whole year to dig. It was more than 6 miles long, with a gradual drop of 32 feet. The opening ceremony was held on Christmas Eve, 1890, and that festive date seemed appropriate. This was a public celebration of the birth of a whole new city. All the citizens came out to watch the water begin to flow. The engineers opened the dike. Water poured in. Fantasy gushed into reality. The natural river fed the man-made river. Useless water became useful. Oklahoma City was transformed. People threw empty barrels into the canal in celebration just to watch them float. But then something terrible happened. The water disappeared. 1 minute the Grand Canal was gushing, and then, all of a sudden, it was dry. Where did the water go? The ground had swallowed it. Nobody understood why. A similar canal in Kansas, dug in similarly sandy prairie soil, had worked just fine. The engineers turned the water back on, and the canal filled back up. Once again, however, the ground swallowed it. This went on, again and again, with increasing desperation, for weeks and months. The new land was thirstier than anyone could have known. Some blamed it on gophers, others on quicksand. But the sickening fact remained, Angelo Scott later wrote, that our canal, the very treasure of our hearts, would not function. It was hard not to read this failure as an ominous metaphor, a message to the settlers from the core of the earth itself. Pour as much as you could into Oklahoma City, it would find a way to make your investment disappear. Every hope would eventually find its disappointment. Every boom would meet its bust.
Always trying. On Thunder game days, the lower bowl of Chesapeake Energy Arena filled up with civic leaders. OKC's mayor and police chief, its oil barons and city council members, its architects and historians and judges and bankers and senators. 40-odd nights a year, for a few charmed hours, all city business ceased so the people could huddle together and cheer. The team's owners sat on the baseline, dodging errant passes. Sometimes you could even find Wayne Coyne, lead singer of OKC's most famous rock band, the Flaming Lips. He would sit courtside with his large flamboyant hair, face covered in glitter, cheering indiscriminately for both teams because he didn't really understand what was going on. "That was wicked," Wayne would shout, and the people around him would point out, not always kindly, that the player he was complimenting was Kobe Bryant, a deeply loathed opponent. And Wayne would look around, slightly confused, and repeat, "But that was wicked." One celebrity you would never find at the arena was Gary England. Although he was a Thunder fan, like everyone else, England was too busy forecasting the weather in the evenings to make it down to the games. This went double during the playoffs, which took place in the spring, at the height of Oklahoma's storm season. People needed England's attention on the sky, not on basketball. Still, he found other ways to show his support. 1 year, during the playoffs, England surprised his producers by slipping on, just before he stepped on camera, a fake James Harden beard. Across the state, on people's TV screens, the familiar tiny blonde man appeared in his usual suit and tie, talking in his usual oaky voice about cold fronts and air pressure and humidity. But now there was a huge black beard hanging off his chin. It was the perfect fusion of OKC worlds, weather and basketball, England and Harden, the sky and the ground. Now, of course, that combination would never happen again. Once, in the early days of the Thunder, Gary England had been called upon to intervene meteorologically on behalf of the team. Scott Brooks, the team's head coach, was new to Oklahoma, and the state's constant wind was driving his family crazy. They lived north of OKC on a golf course, and the low-level jet stream came ripping and howling and moaning around their house, and in the middle of the night it roared like Armageddon, and sometimes the Brooks family was sure that a tornado was about to destroy everything, and they would all leap out of bed and huddle in the closet in terror. Gary England was happy to help. Coach Brooks's wife, Sherry, made a visit to the Channel 9 Weather Center, where England talked to her, as he had talked to generations of Oklahomans, about the ceaseless nature of the region's wind. "It started blowing long before anyone alive was born," England said, "and it would keep blowing long after everyone alive was gone. The state's atmosphere was perpetually unbalanced in a way that sent the air rushing almost always from south to north, on an invisible track from Texas to Kansas. So consistently, in fact, that if you ever happen to find yourself lost in the countryside of Oklahoma, you can just look at the trees. They lean north. Stray newspapers blow north. Traffic lights bob north. The people themselves might lean slightly north. The atmosphere is always trying desperately to balance itself, and yet true equilibrium is impossible, because every flow only creates a new imbalance somewhere else. The wind is a symptom of that endless struggle. This is what was keeping the Brooks family awake at night, the ocean of air over the Great Plains, trying but failing to bring itself to rest. Tornadoes, however, England reassured Mrs. Brooks, are something else entirely. They do not come dropping randomly out of otherwise placid skies. They are the result of absolutely perfect conditions, huge loads of distant air, a warm, wet flow from the Gulf of Mexico, an Arctic blast from Canada, crossing the continent to intersect over Oklahoma. Even then, the jet stream has to fire precisely through the heart of that mixture, twisting normal thunderstorms into deadly supercells. It wasn't something that happened casually. If a major storm was on the way, England said, the Brooks family would be warned well in advance. Modern weathermen understood tornadoes to an astonishing degree of detail. They knew that the funnels tend to spawn in families, that they rotate counterclockwise, and that the very worst of them form at the back edge of a storm, where they can feast, unopposed, on all the moisture left in the atmosphere. They knew that a tornado is often preceded by giant hail, that it usually hits the southwest corner of a house first, and that its parent storm eventually kills it off with its own cold wind. According to England, you could even smell a tornado coming. The air, he said, smelled almost like fish. Not exactly like fish, but almost. It was this degree of expertise that helped the Brooks family, and many others in Oklahoma, sleep at night. Science, however, can only go so far. The weathermen could forecast all day long, but they would never change the central fact about tornadoes, the pure, primal, apocalyptic terror. Once a funnel drops out of the clouds, everyone in the region is suddenly living in a horror movie in which the sky is hunting humans. In the heat of such a crisis, even the weathermen would sometimes abandon their professional detachment, referring to tornadoes on the air as beasts or monsters or hogs. I often found myself staring at tornado footage and wondering, over and over, the most basic questions. What is that thing? Why does it exist? What on earth does it want? I once asked England these questions. He chuckled. "Well, they're kind of like humans," he said. "They're born, and they grow and grow, and when they reach a mature size and run out of conditions, they start to die. Then they go away. They're just like humans, except they don't last very long. But I've known some humans about as mean as them." You don't get to bargain with me. Perhaps the ultimate proof that Kevin Durant was nice, the strongest case for his sainthood, was his ability to tolerate Russell Westbrook. Any other scorer of KD's stature would, no doubt, have bristled at sharing the court with such a petulant, impulsive, cursing, scowling, unbalanced, bullheaded vortex of doom. Durant would have been well within his rights to create a crisis, divide the locker room, demand a trade. He could have forced Sam Presti's hand. But Durant was not a normal superstar, in this or in any other way. Almost always, he handled his co-star with patient grace, even when Westbrook was flying into one of his frenzies or playing keep away from his own teammates. KD was apparently so deeply virtuous that he could absorb his point guard's negative energy on behalf of the people of Oklahoma City, allowing everyone else to focus on Westbrook's positives, which were considerable if you could manage to see them. Traditionally, the job of a point guard is organization. He handles the ball, calls plays, sets up teammates for easy shots, and sacrifices his own immediate glory for the long-term good of the group. He's like an orchestra conductor, balancing hundreds of inputs at once, profoundly aware of the feelings and needs of everyone else on the floor. He leads by deferring. Throughout NBA history, the archetypal point guard has been short, slight, empathetic, and altruistic. Russell Westbrook was a living affront to this tradition. On the court, he was ferociously, maniacally, relentlessly assertive, almost certainly the least deferential human in the arena. He attacked and attacked, even when it made no sense, even when it meant ignoring wide-open teammates to force his own rash shot over multiple defenders. His signature move was the pull-up jumper. He charged toward the rim with reckless lunacy, sending his defender scrambling backward to try to prevent a dunk. At which point, Westbrook would stop, with impossible suddenness, and launch himself straight into the air, like a fighter pilot ejecting from a cockpit. And as the defender continued to stagger helplessly backward, Westbrook would rise and rise, now surrounded by open space, and shoot, all alone. It was a risky, impulsive, individualistic move, by its very nature a gamble. But Westbrook made the shot with surprising frequency. After big plays, Westbrook stomped and strutted all over the court, and every time he sank a three-pointer, he held his hands up in an okay sign, the referee's official signal for a made three, and then thrust them down violently as if he were holstering guns while screaming boom so loud you could hear it many rows up in the crowd. I once happened to be reading an academic book about the history and chemistry of explosives when I stopped to scribble Westbrook in the margin. It should be remembered, the author wrote, that total energy and actual effectiveness are different matters. The effectiveness of an explosive depends, in large part, upon the rate at which its energy is liberated. This was precisely the thing about Russell Westbrook. He liberated all of his energy, in every situation, all at once, over and over. No one has ever chased a loose ball with more urgency. In the third quarter of a meaningless game, Westbrook would leap after a trivial rebound like a man in a winner-takes-all dunk contest against the devil himself. He appeared to be insulted by the very concepts of size, distance, limitations, restraint. To watch him play was to be constantly amazed that another human being could be, somehow, like that. And yet the abundance of Westbrook's energy was not always effective. He could be furiously inefficient. In both of his first two seasons, he led the NBA in turnovers. Even in 2012, when the Thunder reached the finals, Oklahoma City was dead last in the league in passes and assists, damning statistics for a point guard. During the finals itself, with the entire world watching and the Thunder holding a one-game lead, Westbrook fumbled and bumbled the ball so carelessly and launched so many ill-advised shots that Magic Johnson, Westbrook's childhood hero and an unimpeachable authority on point guardism, was moved to declare at halftime of Game 2, "That was the worst point guard in a championship finals I've ever seen." In Westbrook's good moments, however, when the dice came up in his favor, he was incredibly good. Through sheer willpower and self-belief, he found seams in the defense that didn't exist. He dunked when it was not possible, flying screaming hammers that he threw down in the face of the entire world. Every such moment, of course, only confirmed Westbrook's radical self-belief, increasing the likelihood that he would do it again the next time down the floor. His superpower was to exist right on the line between confidence and delusion. His personal motto, which he wrote on his shoes and had printed on his underwear, was simply the question, why not? He once tweeted, apropos of nothing, why not? Hashtag why not? Hashtag why not? In Game 4 of the Finals, only a few days after that disastrous Game 2, Westbrook scored 43 points on an array of shots so wild and improbable, he seemed to be in a fugue state. It was all inseparable. The brilliance was the wildness. The boom was the bust. Meeting Russell Westbrook was exactly the opposite of meeting Kevin Durant. One afternoon, at training camp, I was scheduled to speak with him directly after practice, but he kept me waiting on the edge of the gym for more than an hour. Eventually, Westbrook emerged from the back of the building, escorted by a PR man, and sauntered across the floor. The chaperone, however, was unnecessary. Westbrook shut down all of my questions with ruthless efficiency. A word, a sentence, a stare. I asked him what might surprise me as an outsider to learn about the team. Nothing, he said. No surprises? No, he said. It's self-explanatory. The way we play is the way we act. It felt at times like he was performing some kind of art project about the futility of human connection. Despite my best efforts to keep the conversation going, it petered out in less than 10 minutes, a good percentage of which time Westbrook spent talking on the phone, telling a friend that he was currently doing an interview, but not to worry because it would be over very soon. The PR guys had told me that Westbrook was famous for giving everyone in the organization nicknames. He called various staffers Alfalfa, Ace Ventura, and Snakes on a Plane. I asked him what nicknames he'd given his teammates. Those are my secrets, he said. I asked if he could share any of his secrets. I don't let out secrets. I surrendered and thanked Westbrook for his time. He stood and walked off to take care of some business in the PR office. The PR guys all seemed to genuinely love Westbrook. They defended him all the time to reporters, insisting that he was misunderstood, that he was actually wonderful behind the scenes, charismatic, funny, smart, thoughtful. Nothing at all like he was with us, on the record. But now I watched Westbrook stand in the PR office and complain about the amount of merchandise the company was asking him to sign. He admired a new addition to the room, a big, freestanding, color-coded season schedule, and asked if he could have it. The PR guys said no, they were using it to plan the season, but they would be happy to get another one printed out, especially for him. Westbrook asked why he couldn't just take this one, right now, and then they could get another schedule printed for themselves. That way, he wouldn't have to wait. He was the player, he said. Shouldn't he have priority? Even in the middle of the PR office, in other words, Westbrook was having a PR problem. Witnessing it in person, however, even immediately after my unsuccessful interview, I could see why people liked him. As I watched Westbrook act like a jerk firsthand, it became clear to me that he wasn't actually a jerk, or at least not only a jerk, not uncomplicatedly a jerk, in the same way that Kevin Durant was not uncomplicatedly nice. By traditional social standards, saying the kinds of things Westbrook was saying is bad form. But that's in the same way that, by traditional basketball standards, it's bad form to charge into a 1-on-4 fast break and pull up for a contested free throw line jumper. Until Westbrook, as he regularly does, somehow pulls it off. He was a social gambler as well as a basketball gambler. One of those people who knows how to play on the line between charisma and rudeness, teasing and affection. He was putting on a little show for the PR guys, for himself, and maybe even a little for me. It was fun to watch. For the first time since I'd entered his orbit, I was enjoying myself. Westbrook sat down at one of the PR desks and picked up a stack of documents. He grabbed a pen and started signing. He held the pen in his left hand. Little known fact about Russell, one of the PR guys said. He shoots with his right hand. It says he's right-handed in the media guide, but he writes with his left. Westbrook's head snapped up. He looked straight at me, where I was leaning against the doorframe. Don't put that in your article, he said. I told him we could make a deal. I wouldn't write about it, if he would tell me one of his teammates' nicknames. "You don't get to bargain with me, motherfucker," Westbrook said, with so much venom that I laughed out loud. And he did not smile, but just went back to signing papers with his left hand. There was a surprise, however, buried deep in Russell Westbrook's character. On the court, he was a chaotic, fire-breathing hothead. Off the court, his life was defined by an obsessive commitment to order. On days when Sam Presti wasn't straightening balls at the practice facility, it seemed likely that his starting point guard was. Westbrook built his life around inflexible routines, daily calls to his parents, a designated parking spot, morning shooting on court three, always and only court three. He expected every room to be neat and clean, at work and at home. He had a revulsion to stray hairs. Before every game, Westbrook ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and his requirements for it were so exact, filling spread thin, bread cut on the diagonal, that the Thunder's team chefs had been trained in the proper technique. On the road, Westbrook couldn't trust anyone, so he made the sandwich himself. He was compulsively aware of the tiniest details of his shoes, color schemes, sole flexibility, insole thickness, to the point that, uniquely among the players, he had his own personal shoe rack in the back of the practice facility. He decided himself which pairs came on every road trip. On the team plane, Westbrook sometimes got so absorbed in film study that he woke his teammates up in the middle of the night to show them an angle they had missed on a play. At the arena, he took the floor exactly 3 hours before tip-off, every game, and his warm-up routine ended invariably with the same shot, a rainbow from behind the basket out of bounds, and as soon as he made it, he sprinted, at full speed, directly to the locker room. Precisely 1 hour before tip-off, Westbrook went to chapel, and when the pregame countdown clock hit 6:17, not a second more or less, Westbrook leaped off the bench and screamed, "Two lines!" to initiate the team's final layup drill. I once asked him if there was some kind of numerology behind this, a June 17th birthday, a favorite Bible verse. "No particular reason," he said. "I just do it. Nothing special." This was the paradox of Russell Westbrook. What looked like chaos was built on a foundation of intense self-control. He grew up in inner-city Los Angeles, where his father meticulously structured his sons' lives to keep them away from trouble. Westbrook and his father ran through endless drills at the local park, laboring over his pull-up jump shot, again and again and again and again, until that impulsive burst became automatic, algorithmic, until chaos merged with order. Control was how Russell Westbrook survived. When he looked wild on the court, it was only the flip side of his focus. His mind could reduce the entire universe to one immediate goal, outside of which everything, teammates, opponents, fans, journalists, shrank to nothing. It was control so extreme, it was avant-garde, control that wrapped all the way back around to wildness. This is why Presti and Oklahoma City were so enamored of him. Once, I asked someone in the organization if, in addition to loving Westbrook, everyone was also scared of him. There was a significant silence. "I wouldn't say scared," he answered finally, "but I would say that he keeps us on edge." Westbrook's personality, the sheer intensity of his presence, seeped into every square centimeter of the Thunder organization. When he was around, everyone was aware of him, and he was never not around. Players arrived at the gym in the morning to find him already there. Sometimes they came in at night to shoot, and he would be there again, in the weight room, working out. In the afternoons, he sat in the back of the practice facility, writing checks, paying his bills. Westbrook always paid his own bills. People thought twice, and often a third and fourth time, before mentioning something they weren't sure Westbrook would like, whether it was an interview request or a meme. He created a constant low-grade tension. This struck me as perhaps a deliberate tool, a way for Westbrook to extend his own unusual focus to the people around him. His personality was like a grinding stone. He dragged blades across it, all the time, to keep them sharp. Everyone around him got dragged too, whether they felt like being sharpened or not. Federal larceny. Very quickly, after the opening surge of the land run, Oklahoma City's population began to slide backward. Once hopeful settlers were driven away by fear, poverty, hunger, and lack of good land. There was very little decent work. New land grabs in other parts of Indian Territory drew people off to try their luck elsewhere. By the end of its first year, the instant city of 10,000 had dwindled to only 4,000. OKC was failing to thrive. The land run had come too late in the season to establish a viable crop, and soon food was dangerously scarce. Those who remained clung to their land, waiting for the town to mature into its promised glory, enduring the nearly constant drama, the mass meetings and failed coups, the bayonets in the streets, the shocking death of Mayor Couch, the failure of the Grand Canal. After a while, these allegedly self-sufficient settlers, men who had clamored at Congress for so many years to be given access to Oklahoma, who had insisted that the tribes were only wasting paradise, had to swallow their pride and ask the federal government to bail them out. Distribution of the donated goods, flour, potatoes, beans, sugar, pork, was entrusted to Angelo Scott. Demand for it, he reported, was very brisk. It was at this vulnerable moment, when the pride of the town had already been so badly wounded, when its very future seemed to be in question, that the United States Congress twisted the knife. It announced that the official capital of the newly created Territory of Oklahoma would not be Oklahoma City, but a rival town 30 miles to the north, Guthrie. Guthrie, alas, was a reasonable choice. It, too, had been a major destination in the land run, another instant city of roughly 10,000. It, too, offered settlers a magical combination of river and railroad. Now, in the spring of 1890, 1 year after the drama of the run, Guthrie was emerging as Oklahoma City's most serious enemy, not only a competitor, but an actual existential threat. Imagine the indignity. Guthrie's population was fully a third higher than OKC's, and it had grand buildings, 8 newspapers, and 11 schools. It was, by many measures, handling its business. But of course, Oklahoma City was not interested in second place. It still considered itself, somehow, the superior city. Capital status was not simply a question of pride. It was about survival. The prairie was littered with ruined towns that would soon disappear from maps. Ball, Buckhead, Waterloo, Dodsworth, Thurston, Springvale, Paradise. In these places, hope had outrun reality. Once a town got weak, the railroads could hold it ransom, asking for fees in exchange for continued service. The odds of survival got worse and worse. A capital city, however, would be safe from such bullying. It would be sustained by official decrees, recognized not only around the nation, but across the world. For Oklahoma City, capital status would provide the one thing the city had always, by its very nature, lacked. Stability. And so, Oklahoma City leaders fought, with the mighty righteousness of undeserved pride, to steal the capital from Guthrie. In the territorial legislature, the OKC faction tried to force capital relocation votes over and over, only to be thwarted by the Guthrie faction. Once again, as in the case of the Grand Canal, all of OKC became united by an obsession. Seminoles and Kickapoos joined hands. For days and weeks, Angelo Scott remembered, we talked of nothing else and thought of nothing else but the capital fight. It was a bottomless pit, absorbing civic energy that should have gone to more basic issues, water, food, revenue, order. At the territory's first legislative session, one historian writes, 100 days were spent on that problem and 10 days on other matters. There were arguments and altercations, including an episode in which a representative from OKC, falsely believed to be in possession of the relocation bill, was chased around the city by representatives from Guthrie. He escaped by hiding for 3 hours behind an icebox in a butcher shop. Finally, using every ounce of its influence, Oklahoma City managed to force a relocation vote, It even narrowly won. But it still didn't matter. Washington, D.C. was by now so thoroughly acquainted with OKC's nonsense that it had appointed, as territorial governor, a hard military man, a veteran of Sherman's infamous march to the sea, and he immediately vetoed the bill. This was a civic catastrophe. Guthrie would hold the capital, intolerably, for another 20 years. Oklahoma City survived. Life went on. Angelo Scott continued to pour his civilizing energy into the town. He harmonized with his choirmates, delivered lectures, wrote for the paper, and attended plays and galas. He once rescued a large crowd of people from a burning church downtown. From his office on Main Street, Scott helped the federal courts sift through all of the many property disputes left over after the land run. Among other things, they found that William Couch had died for no reason. The court ruled that he had not legally owned the land he was shot over, and neither, for that matter, had the man who shot him. In 1893, the governor chose Angelo Scott to represent Oklahoma Territory at the Chicago World's Fair. When he got back, he was elected president of the Territorial Senate, a position he used to fight against the death penalty and the barbaric sport of prize fighting. Everyone urged him to run for governor, but Scott declined. Politics was not his passion. His true purpose was to make sure Oklahoma City flourished, spiritually as well as materially. In 1894, 5 years after the land run, when the town had begun to stabilize somewhat, Angelo Scott increased its population by one. He married, and then somehow induced to come to the frontier, a musician named Lola May Smeltzer. They had grown up together in Kansas, back in Scott's previous life, long before all of this Oklahoma madness began. Lola and Angelo seemed like a perfect match. She had studied at a conservatory in Boston and was an avid reader of poetry and novels and plays. In Oklahoma City, the two were an instant cultural power couple. Lola wrote regular letters to the territorial legislature, arguing for better treatment of juvenile offenders. She became president of Oklahoma's Federation of Women's Clubs, a network of cultured ladies who gathered in the town's fancier houses to discuss such lofty topics as Hamlet, Homer, Saki, Maeterlinck, and the Irish mystic A.E. Not long after Lola's arrival, Oklahoma City's luck finally shifted. In 1898, after many years of suffocating drought, the sky erupted. The flat earth was ecstatically wet. As a result, Oklahoma City experienced something it had been waiting for since the land run, a new boom. The Great Plains exploded into agricultural life, and all of the wealth of the farms came pouring from the countryside into the city, where it was stacked and sorted and traded and sold and shipped out on the railroads. Wooden buildings turned to brick. Brick buildings turned to stone. The city spasmed and expanded. New residents flooded in. By 1900, Oklahoma City was, once again, a city of 10,000. It had recovered all of the population it had lost in that first bad year. More railroads arrived. Streetcar lines began to stretch across the town, carrying residents out of the city center to increasingly far-flung clusters of houses, and even to other cities. On one of these lines, in a town called Stillwater, Angelo Scott was hired to serve as president of an agricultural and mechanical college, where farmers' children came to learn about Shakespeare and Mozart and scientific soil management techniques. The wealth rolled in and multiplied, sloshing all over the early years of the new century. Oklahoma City hit 20,000 residents, then 30,000, then 50,000. New neighborhoods bloomed. Developers bought up land at formerly desolate mudflats and began to fill them with houses. The claim that William Couch had died for, way out on the edge of town, would now have been absorbed into the city, proving his gamble right. To the north of the crowded downtown, on a slight rise at the edge of the river's floodplain, a neighborhood of mansions rose up. These were huge new homes for the city's elite, the bankers and politicians and businessmen, the winners of the booms. The neighborhood boasted luxuries unknown in other parts of the city. Sidewalks, ample yards, elm trees, pocket parks. "Come live with the big bugs," the developer's advertisements read. The architecture was grand in a way that was pure Oklahoma City, eclectic to the point of absurdity. There were mansions that looked like Greek temples, French chateaus, Spanish villas, and German gingerbread hunting lodges. There were imitation Italian Renaissance palazzos, complete with statuary and orange-tiled roofs. It was like a theme park of global fanciness. The brand new city was attempting to replicate, in Fast Forward, all of the majestic European styles that had simmered into being over centuries. The men who lived in these mansions were city boosters whose names would someday adorn the streets and landmarks downtown. Colcord, Overholzer, Klassen, Chartel, Gaylord. In such flush days, it seemed even more outrageous that Oklahoma City was not the capital. The city was no longer struggling to survive, no longer begging the federal government for food. It was now, by far, the grandest city in the territory. OKC's population was more than 60,000, three times the size of Guthrie's. It was a major railroad hub, a center for the livestock trade, and the primary engine of the territorial economy. Skyscrapers as high as 8 and 9 stories were beginning to rise downtown. And yet Washington, D.C. still seemed determined to spite the place. In 1907, the stakes of the capital fight went up significantly when Oklahoma, the former wasteland, became an honest-to-God United States state, the 46th in the nation. Teddy Roosevelt signed the order himself. It was the wildest fantasy of men who were now dead and buried. Oklahoma was suddenly the equal of New York, Massachusetts, and Virginia. The only bitterness was that Guthrie, not Oklahoma City, had been elevated to true capital status, on equal footing with Boston and Richmond and Atlanta. It was in the middle of Guthrie, not OKC, that 30,000 citizens gathered for a statehood ceremony featuring a symbolic wedding between Mr. Oklahoma, played for the occasion by Charles Gristmill Jones, an OKC businessman and former mayor, and Miss Indian Territory, a local woman of Cherokee descent. One of the official statehood provisions was that Guthrie would hold the capital for at least 6 more years, until 1913. A legitimate U.S. state needed stability, and Oklahoma City, despite its recent business success, could hardly be trusted with that. But Oklahoma City was done waiting. City leaders argued that the federal government had no right to fix a state's capital against the will of its people. In defiance of Washington, OKC decided to organize a special election. The city's secret power players began to ply their secret powers. E.K. Gaylord, owner of the Oklahoman, used his influence to launch a strategic PR campaign. He sent his circulation men to distribute petitions demanding a public vote for relocation, while at the same time keeping the story out of the newspapers so Guthrie couldn't counterattack. It worked. In June of 1910, a special statewide election would be held to determine, once and for all, which city deserved the glory of representing the new state of Oklahoma. OKC's PR machine cranked as hard as it could. Billboards went up, extolling the city's virtues, its centrality, its tall buildings, its 94 miles of paved roads. "It has the best churches and schools," the advertisements claimed. "Its hotels are best and biggest. It has the best public and private buildings. Its building operations are the talk of the country. It has the finest boulevard and park system in the Southwest." These claims ranged from debatable to absurd. The boulevard and park system, for instance, didn't actually exist. It was a quixotic plan to build a racetrack circling the city, connecting 4 huge parks at its corners. But after almost a decade of planning, it would be abandoned, half-built. The city, however, was unable to meaningfully distinguish between its fantasies of the future and its actual present, and it would say anything, at this point, to increase its chances of stealing the capital. On the day of the relocation vote, one historian contends that OKC resorted to election fraud, mobilizing the homeless encampment on the riverbank, the so-called hobo roost to stuff the ballot box. But this would not have been necessary. In the end, the results were not even close. Oklahoma City won in a landslide, garnering more than 70% of the vote to vanquish